What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm senior editor Devinder Hardwar, joined this morning by senior reporter Igor Bonifacic. Hey, Igor, how's it going?
Hey, Dev, thanks so much for having me.
Happy to have you here, because you did a really good Apple piece about how the RAM crisis could actually help them in the PC market. So we're going to talk about that and RAM. Apple turning 50 in general. Also joining us is podcast producer Ben Elman. Hey, Ben.
Hey, everybody. I'm excited about space.
I thought you were going to rap. I thought you were going to turn this into a parappa, you know.
No. No.
What's the song? Turn to the left. Turn to the left. Now turn to the right. We'll also be talking about the Artemis 2 launch, which went off successfully yesterday. Thankfully, I was freaking out because I was watching that with my kids. So thankfully, that's gone without a hitch so far, only some minor glitches. We'll talk about some of those. As always, if you're enjoying the show, please be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Leave us a review on iTunes and drop us an email at podcastengadget.com. We love getting your letters. You can also join us Thursday mornings around 10:30 a.m. Eastern on our YouTube channel. Tune in to see our faces. Sometimes we'll show off gadgets and we'll definitely talk to the audience. So tune in for that. So this is the year. This is the time Apple is turning 50. I'm seeing a lot of like remembrance pieces everywhere. A lot of like, how did Apple get here? We did a couple of stories, but I really like yours, Igor, because you basically framed it as to where Apple is today. And your story is the RAM crisis is Apple's best chance in decades to capture the PC market. I think this is a very good point. It's kind of something we were talking about leading up to the MacBook Neo and around the MacBook Neo. But can you talk about your piece and your argument here, Igor?
Yeah. I mean, I think I just mostly looked at it like, I think the PC, as much as we're like AI all the time now, is still maybe one of the most important devices we have, you know, whether, you know, for work or for, you know, personal use. And I think it's historically always been like such an important part of Apple's DNA, and really, like, you know, commoditization, as I say in the article, has always worked against it. But that doesn't apply now, right? Like when one component costs 30% of the cost of a PC, other companies can't compete with Apple on commoditization, right? They don't have this backstop that is the services revenue, the iPhone revenue, to really just go ham, right? And I think I didn't get a chance to really go into the piece because this into the piece because I think it would be like too, it would have been too long. But like the why of it is, I think, like, you know, if we do believe that the AI bubble is a bubble and things are going to go maybe not exactly the way they were before, but if it does, you know, like if we are at a point where like computers become more affordable again, this is the time to really just like go hard and try to make take back or take as much of that market share as possible. Because I think, you know, it is in a way like a really smart business strategy long term, because then, you know, if you get people on the Neo and they really love that experience, they're going to be more inclined to sign up for Apple services. So it's a win-win.
I'm feeling vindication over here, right? Because before the Neo launched, like just based on all the rumors we were hearing, what I saw was a device that was potentially inexpensive and that could really put Apple in a place that was better than a lot of Windows PC makers. And then we saw the thing, and it's $600, and I reviewed it, and it performs really well, even though it has pretty limited specs. Quality-wise, blows away everything away in the PC industry. And I don't know if Apple's taking a hit to just make that possible, because they're not really a company that tends to... they don't really pay to make people buy things. They make things often more expensive than they should be, and then people buy them based on the hype and maybe the level of quality around it too. I'm looking at the AirPods Pro Max or the AirPods Max 2, which are still $550, still among the most expensive noise canceling headphones you can buy, and yet people buy them, even if the Sony headphones may make more sense or the Bose headphones may make more logical sense to get. Like, Apple's always been in this interesting place, and the Neo felt like just an interesting reframing. And maybe Apple's done this a couple times, right? Like, what is a computer? And I feel like since its beginning, Apple has been the company thinking really hard about what is a computer? How do you bring this to the people? Because this is a company, when Apple started, when it was Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak trying to like come up with a project together, they were building circuit boards. They were trying to make pre-built circuit boards that would be something people could use to build their own computers down the line, right? That's kind of what the Apple One was, a really simple box, like a DIY PC box, but they kind of put a lot of the pieces together. The Apple II was more of like, okay, what is a computer? Back before we really had the concept of a personal computer, it's a box that, you know, with a monitor and a keyboard and a mouse and an interface, right? Like, that's something. There are the stories of Bill Gates going and seeing Steve Jobs' demo macOS for the first time and seeing the pointer, the mouse interface, and being like, that's a good idea. And it was Wozniak and Jobs. And Jobs, I think, was just like, don't shut up. Stop like showing this too much. Stop telling our secrets here. The idea of a computer on your desk that was like an all-in-one thing, that was a Mac in the 70s, in the 80s. They kind of refined that. You fast forward to like the 90s, right? What is a computer? What is a PC? It's a colorful, cute, friendly thing on your desk, right? That's the iMac era. What is, then they would like reframe things like the iPod was like, okay, you have a large library of music on your PC. What if you could take it with you anywhere? So that's sort of like the evolution of the Walkman. And everything kind of converged at the iPhone. And to me, we don't call the iPhone a personal computer, but it literally is your most personal computer. If you're an iPhone user, your smartphone is your most personal computer because it's always on you. It's always connected. You probably spend more screen time there than anywhere else. And iPhone redefined how we thought of smartphones, but they didn't forget about PCs. I think it was Joanna Stern who wrote a good piece at The Verge. I just saw the headline, but a good idea that the MacBook Air was probably Apple's most influential product. And when you think about laptops, I was working in an IT department at the time at my college when Steve Jobs debuted the original MacBook Air, which was a really expensive, underpowered thing, but he pulled it out of a yellow manila envelope. And just the idea that a computer could be that thin and that small kind of redefined like how we thought of laptops moving forward. So there have been all these different stages. Apple shift towards M-series chips, I think, is a big one, too, like chips they build themselves, but which are essentially mobile chips. And it's interesting that the Neo is like the convergence of a new idea. Hey, it looks like a laptop, but it's actually powered by a really, really, really low power mobile chip. And what's the difference, really? Because it's good.
Wait,
it's
low power or high power?
So we're in just like a really interesting place. Are there any other, like, I don't know, aspects or highlights in Apple's history you want to highlight, Igor, that kind of speak to this, just this idea that they've been shaping things throughout their entire history?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, like you were talking about the iPhone convergence, and it's like literally that, you know, the presentation that Steve Jobs did, right? Like he was really, you know, that is probably maybe one of the greatest product reveals in history. And, you know, a big part of that was he's like, remember, he's like, don't you get it? It's just one device. It's not three separate devices. It's just one device. I believe the MacBook Neo does represent another, you know, maybe it's hard to say now because we're in this moment and looking back at it, we'll have, you know, the fullness of time with which we can judge this. But I do believe that like we are in another one of these moments where the computer is being redefined. And I think, you know, I saw this great Blue Sky tweet about it, which someone's like, you know, a personal computer is like a horse, right? It's like, it's this like skittish creature, but it can do so much, right? And I have always been a firm believer that the personal computer, the PC, is the kind of the best version of, you know, forget smartphones because smartphones are this like closed environment, but like the PC is still the most powerful expression of what a computer can be. And so the fact that they're still working on this gives me hope for the future of technology, that it's not just going to be something where you're renting compute from the cloud, you know. And
well, it's, if you're big into AI now, if you're like big on like doing as much as you can in AI, aren't you essentially renting your computing from the cloud?
Yeah.
You know, for a lot of these folks. So I feel like we're kind of going backwards a little bit, and something a lot of AI boosters, or at least the people who really want to use AI for their own purposes, they're building OpenClaw machines, right? They're getting a Mac Mini and putting an LLM on it and making a thing that's catered to their own needs and services. So they're homebrewing an AI PC. It's way back. It's way back to like the origins of Apple. And it's funny how the Mac Mini has ended up being like a really good device for that too, because it's relatively inexpensive. It's powerful. It doesn't draw much power. Like, it's really well suited to this environment. Just interesting. It's an interesting thing where we are right now. And I don't know, like, there were times where it felt like Apple didn't recognize the power of the personal computer. At least they were so focused on, okay, we got the iPhone. This is the biggest thing in the world. This is a whole new idea of how we think of computers. How do we build on the iPhone? We have an iPad, right? It's a bigger iPhone, but it's a screen. Maybe this is the future of computing. Maybe everything should just be iPad. And it felt like throughout the 2010s, that's what Apple was trying to push, right? With the iPad Air, certainly when they got to the iPad Pro, the idea that the Macs may be dead, right? We're not going to think as much about Macs. That may be more just for professionals. It didn't seem like they were thinking about Macs that much in the 2010s, right? That was the era where everything went USB-C. They tried to go all streamlined, didn't have the ports people needed. It felt like they were ignoring actual professional PC users for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, you know, this is an interesting inflection point because, like, where does the iPad go from here, right? And I think it'll be massively de-emphasized relative to the Neo, right? Because, I mean, I think the Neo represents the vision of, you know, that we were sold like 10, 15 years ago, more so than the iPad has ever done, right? Like, and it's still running Mac OS, so you can really do so much with it, so much more than any Chromebook, right? So much more than any PC at this price point. And I think that's really powerful. And like, again, I think this gives me hope for the vision of, for the future of computing, that it's still going to be devices that you can touch and hold and own and do what you want to do with it, right?
Mm-hmm. It's sort of like, we bring this up a lot, but I feel like Apple is almost a bit like Nintendo in terms of like a very successful company that can be iconoclastic, that can do its own thing and not necessarily follow all, every single headwind of the industry. That's kind of been their style, right? So we're going to talk about like, hey, a lot of people complain that it seemed like Apple was slow to AI. They were slow to jump on the LLM bandwagon. That's why we saw Apple Intelligence. They kind of hastily put a lot of that together. There's a partnership with OpenAI to integrate ChatGPT into Apple Intelligence. There was a failure to produce a smarter Siri. It seemed like there were a lot of stumbling blocks, but you know, as we were living through that, it also felt to me we were seeing a lot of PC companies, we were seeing Microsoft and everybody else double down on AI as a sort of vague concept and bake it into all their stuff and make it such an essential thing. And now we're at a point where Microsoft is like, hey, turns out our users don't actually want this. Maybe they're not seeing the engagement they want, but they're pulling back on Copilot stuff. They're trying to refocus on Windows as like the core computing stuff that people actually like. And Apple just kept doing like, they kept focusing on the core stuff, and the AI stuff seemed a little tangential to them. Even then, I was like, you know what? We don't know how important these AI tools and things will be. We don't know how mature they are. Maybe it's not worth overinvesting these things immediately until you really see the shape of this technology. And I do think kind of going forward, Apple is probably in a better place than Microsoft and the PC makers when it comes to AI, at least. Like, being slow has helped them a little bit.
Okay, but this is a situation that's more like a silent movie, physical comedy fall of like, oops, we landed in a good situation.
Sure.
It just so happens that we have met the moment accidentally.
Because
it weren't for maybe the last like 2 to 3 months of news about AI psychosis and other things, I think we would still be talking about like John Gruber's post on Daring Fireball about, man, you guys really messed this AI stuff up.
I don't know if that's
you?
Necessarily true, because even back then, it was like, Microsoft is all in on AI and what do they have to show for it, right? It was a whole bunch of crappy features that nobody actually wanted, and that just elicited a lot of like pushback from the users. How do you feel, Igor?
Well, this is a great point, Dev, and I kind of mentioned this in my article, but, you know, so I asked Qualcomm about the chip mm-hmm. that could potentially match this, right? And I got silence, right? And it's interesting because it's
that could match what specifically? The Neo's chip?
Yeah, so, and they have a chip that is supposed to match it, right? The Snapdragon X2 Plus, right? And I, like, went on their site. It only lists 4 computers with this, only one of which is available, right? And it costs way more than the Neo, right? And so I'm like, hey, what's going on with the ship? And I got radio silence, like just nothing, right? Like, so I think, you know, like to Ben's point, like, yeah, they fumbled into this, but you have to be good to be lucky and lucky to be good, right? And so I think like, you know, they like, whether it was by accident, which I think it probably was, like, I think, you know, sometimes this is what it takes, right? Like, you're not going to predict the headwinds all the time, right? And sometimes you just get lucky. And for Apple, like, I think they're now in like a once, like I write in the article, a once in a generation opportunity to just really like change the face of the PC market, which could have ramifications to many other markets.
And it's funny, like that is basically just going back to building a good basic ass computer, right? And what the Neo is, it has AI stuff. It has Apple Intelligence, but it is a good basic ass computer for $600. Mm-hmm. It is a gauntlet throw down to the rest of the industry to be like, do this, make a screen this good, a camera this good, a keyboard that feels this good at this price range. It's impossible for anybody else.
Integrated memory that is this good. That's really important.
That's really the thing. And that's the stuff that they have spent so long baking on. Like, it is worth talking about that because that is the crux of your PC, Igor. Like, what is so special about Apple's integrated memory? It's not like normal laptop memory, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's unified, and so which means that the CPU and GPU can access it equally, right, and share the
resources. It's all one chip. Separate modules.
So
a system on a chip.
Yes, a system on a chip. Yes, and then of course, if it ever runs out of the 8 gigabytes, it can also access, you know, the storage, right, and use that. So, as I say in the piece, like they didn't arrive at this by accident, right? They've been working on this for more than a decade, right? And so, you know, I wonder, like, yes, you have the Qualcomm side of it, but like, is there really, like, could Windows OEMs feasibly respond to this technically, just on a technical level, forget everything else, right? And yeah. I don't think so, right? Because there's just too much bloat in Windows. They're not vertically integrated like Apple, right? Like they
even Windows on ARM. Like Windows on ARM is more efficient, is more performant now, but it took Microsoft practically 5 years to deal with Windows on ARM, which is something that Apple was able to do. Hey, we're moving to new chip architecture. You macOS developers that we own, get this operating system reworked. And they did that in the span of a couple of years. So that the idea of a reworked ARM-focused macOS, that launched in 2020, along with the M-series chips. It took Microsoft a long, long time to make Windows on ARM feel as good as that. So you're right, Ben. Like, a lot of this is a happy accident. But the accident is that in this scenario, Apple was doing what they typically do, which is be slow, take a step back, and try to do something in an optimized way. They weren't the first to the MP3 players. I owned a Zen. Was it a Zen? I owned an iRiver.
Creative Zen. Yeah.
Creative Zen. I owned the I don't know if I owned it. The Rio. I owned the Rio Karma, which was this beautiful, beautiful little machine with like a jog dial, and I loved that thing. There were so many MP3 players at the point. Apple won by making this beautiful device that was expensive, but also doing the industry work to be like, hey, where do you get that music that goes on these players? It needs to be a storefront. It needs to be a unified storefront. It needs to be have the participation of all the record labels so you could just buy the music. Because before that, you had to like go on Napster, go on Audio Galaxy. Like you were scrounging the internet for audio files or ripping CDs on your own. And not everybody was doing that. The iPhone, not everybody. That was not the first smartphone. The BlackBerry was around for a long time before that. There were Pocket PCs from Microsoft. Again, a situation where Microsoft was in early, but didn't have the juice to like, didn't have that spark to make it a worldwide hit. We've talked about this before, but I really love the BlackBerry movie. Such a good one, and has that moment. It has the iPhone launch moment dramatized from within the offices of BlackBerry. And it's such like, you see the people who've been working so hard to produce this thing, like a really cool pocket computer. And then Steve Jobs comes on and says like, here's the iPhone. It doesn't have a keyboard. It's doing all these things beyond what BlackBerry is doing. And it's easy to be in that office and see so many of them like dismiss it because, hey, it doesn't have a keyboard. How do you type on it? So many things about it are bad. And yet the vision of the iPhone kind of moved forward. So I don't know. Anything you want to add?
Was the iPhone the thing that really popularized multi-touch too?
Absolutely. I think yes.
Well, I mean, that's a huge, huge deal on its own. Like, that might be the big step forward on top of better cameras and just a better operating system. I remember seeing a TED talk about capacitive multi-touch before it was popular. And thinking like, wow, when is this going to like hit our consumer gadgets? It was way sooner than we expected.
The BlackBerry's pocket PCs all typically required styluses. And that's how you worked on the resistive touchscreens before. Or even if you didn't have stylus, you had to like press into that screen. So the idea like, oh, this is a piece of glass and I'm just swiping on it. It's like a symphony with my fingers. And now we take it all for granted. But that is essentially, that's what Apple started there too. You know, Android was right behind them, and then Google picked that up and kind of, you know, kept that going. But even today, you can kind of see the differences between like Apple understanding like, hey, this is a whole new interface. We need touch. We need to really think hard about this, and how Android has approached it, which is kind of haphazard. It's very much the Windows thing. It's like one software platform, a lot of different hardware designers. And it's really hard to unify people around specific designs, specific technologies. Again, Qualcomm's a part of that too. It's so confusing. So anyway, that's kind of where Apple is now. Like, they're in a very good place because they own the hardware, they own the software, they tightly control all of this. I was in a blue sky argument with somebody who refused to look at the MacBook Neo because they were like, Apple is a monopoly. They are just like keeping you in their closed system. And it's like, well, it's not a monopoly. It's their platform. It's a closed platform. Yes, it's not a monopoly because it's not the biggest PC platform in the world. That would be Windows. You could argue maybe iOS or the App Store is a monopoly given the stranglehold they have on the mobile economy. That's a different argument.
Ask Epic about that.
Ask Epic. That's a whole different argument. Ask the EU about that. Nobody is saying macOS has a monopoly on anything because it's been such a small part of the PC industry for so long, you know?
Big question to Igor, then. Where is Apple going? What do you think is going to be happening in, let's say, a five-year span with, like, most of the focus on, you know, the fifth year? Because, and you're laughing because you're like, I have no idea. I have no idea what the tech industry is going to do, like, next month.
Yeah. I mean, I have no idea, right? But, like, I imagine, like, I think AI is not going to go away, but it is going to be, I think, mostly just for enterprise use, right? Like, which it really always should have been, right? And so it has like a lot of use cases there. Like the example I can think of is like, you know, so Anthropic just released this like, you know, Claude can now use your computer, right? And like do things
Yay.
On your computer, right?
Yeah.
And they warn you, it's like, oh yeah, like things could go terribly wrong and it just might like completely flub it, right? Like, and it's like, I think, you know, like the thing with AI as a consumer, like when it makes that like first like big mistake for you, like at first you're like, oh, like this is so cool, right? And then it like makes that first big mistake and you're like, this is useless, right? Like at least that's
you may not even understand that there was a mistake. Consumers are out here clicking on random links in text, and that text starts a worm that takes over their phone and their personal data is out there. They don't know how this is happening.
Yeah.
You know, like it's such a, AI is such like a conceptually different thing for people to think about when they have trouble just checking their email already.
Yeah. So I think like, you know, the ways in which like I really do feel like Apple has a position, or to answer your question, has like a chance here to come out even stronger than they are right now, right? Like it, you know, so the CEO of SK Hynix, which is one of the biggest memory manufacturers, he's predicted that this isn't going to end until 2030, right? That's like a crazy
Bruh.
2030, right? We're like thinking like I don't, you know, so.
Okay, that's 4 years from now, but also it hurts thinking that 2030 is 4 years from now.
Right.
It hurts. It absolutely hurts.
But so that's like a level of disruption that I like, I want to say, like, I don't think some companies are going to come out of, right? Like, you know,
yeah,
I don't know if you like talked about a dev, but like, you know, so I did a piece where I talked to Rabbit about the device they're working on. And, you know, the whole like elephant in the room is like, well, like how, like, you know, the goal there is to make it $500, right? And it's like, but the memory, right? Like,
yeah, we talked about that because it was like that thing was announced, Igor, the week the MacBook Neo reviews hit.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what are you, how, you can't do this, Rabbit. You could barely produce an AI device. You cannot do this thing that the PC manufacturers
so I talked to Jesse, the CEO, and he seems like he's, you know, like that they can do it, but it's still like a huge, you know, like question mark, right? And you know, Rabbit is a small company, so let's set them aside for, but even like the HPs of the world, right? Like the margins are going to get so thin so quickly. And, you know, like there's, I think like at a certain point, it's like, you're going to lose consumers because if you want to protect the margins, you're going to have to raise the price of these computers. And then they look even worse relative to what like Apple is offering, right? It might come to the point where like the MacBooks are not that much significantly more expensive than their PC counterparts, right? And at that point, completely different ball game, right? Like,
yeah. I mean, I think that's been true for years. The MacBook Air, by that thing, at one point, like the best version of it in the last few years was $1,000, and they raised the price slightly with the M2 redesign, but that, it was back down to 1,000. Now it's up a little bit based on the market. That price for a premium ultra portable, that's still where most Windows PCs sit. So I feel like that parity is already there. It only becomes like the Apple tax when you start to go high end, right? When you want a MacBook Pro and you want more RAM or more storage, well, then you're paying a lot. You're paying a lot for a larger hard drive and you have no way of putting a bigger SSD in there yourself or more RAM or anything, which you could do in Windows systems. So like those are the kind of differences there. But I agree with you, Igor, like they are, just in terms of their power and how much of the market that they do hold when it comes to overall memory, they have the ability to like withstand these price pressures more. Maybe they'll get slightly more expensive, but also Apple has a core audience of people who don't mind paying a little more for this hardware. What is amazing is that in this time when things are so volatile, they can produce a $600 MacBook Neo. And that thing is $500 if you have the education discount, which is even more insane. What's up, Ben?
Speaking of which, Mo Esquire says in the YouTube chat that I hate Apple for many reasons, but honestly, it was a smart move for them to buy Samsung's RAM, even at its marked up price. They're the least phased by the shortages and can price hardware aggressively.
Yeah, I mean, like, imagine a world where, so like, I think, you know, Apple has gained PC market share on just the back of like the technological advantage that the series has. But then imagine like if they also compete on price. Right. Like at that point, that's like the game is over for the time being. Right. Yeah.
You hit a good quote from the Asus CEO who was like, that MacBook Neo. We're worried. We're basically worried is what he was saying.
Yeah.
It's also worth pointing out last week after our podcast, several people noticed that Apple killed the Mac Pro. And this is the Mac Pro that was introduced in 2023 and which sort of just seemed like a sort of like here you whiners who say we don't have a computer with like a configurable PCI and stuff you can plug in, here's that computer for you. And I have a feeling nobody bought it, or at least very few people bought it, because you look at the Mac Studio, which is basically the bigger Mac Mini, you stuff hardware into the Mac Studio, like that is all the power even production studios need in a machine. And it could be very expensive. It can hold a lot of RAM and hold a lot of storage. You could also expand storage with Thunderbolt. Like, you don't need a giant configurable desktop anymore. If you want to predict like where Apple's going, they definitely went away from that. I don't think we'll see the Mac Pro come back, because why? You don't need it. You barely need to build a mid-tower, or certainly not a full-tower PC anymore.
Yeah.
I don't know what your feelings are about the Mac Pro, Igor.
Yeah, I mean, I think it makes sense from the perspective of like, if you think about like rendering workflows and stuff, like you're there mostly dependent on RAM and processor, right? And it's less so the GPU, and the GPU is almost often why you would go for a bigger enclosure because of like the size of it. But even now, like, you know, I am like such an SPF nerd where like I just love really small factor PCs and like trying to figure out how to build the smallest one with the biggest GPU. And you know, like, you, like, if you haven't followed this space, there's some like amazing videos on YouTube of like people building these kind of things. And the amount of like,
seems like there's probably some overlap between this and CyberDex.
That's a whole separate topic. Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah. We've been talking about maybe getting a segment about CyberDex onto the show sometime soon because, well, they seem really interesting.
Real quick,
anyway,
CyberDex.
Igor, go on about
You brought up CyberDex and now we have to explain what they are. But God, real quick, those are like DIY.
Listeners to this little show should know.
No, not everybody knows. But these are DIY hacked together mini computers. It can look like a laptop. It can look like a desktop. It could be, this is like the hacker aesthetic. This is so cyberpunk right now. I'm seeing the people talk about like building them on TikTok, but yeah, the future is small.
Like, imagine one of those tin lunch boxes, kind of like 50s style lunch boxes, and you open it up and the lid on the hinge has like a screen, and then the rest of it has like all the guts of the computer, which is most likely a Raspberry Pi in a lot of cases.
It's almost always a Raspberry, but it looks cool. But I think the big takeaway from that, and also from what Apple is doing, look at the MacBook Neo. Look at how great the Mac Mini is, like, and what people can do with it. The future is small and not big ass towers. That's basically it.
Yeah, and a tower is really necessitated by just thermals, right? And Apple has the advantage on that too, right? Because it's, you know, there are efficiency cores. It's such an efficient design that integrates all these parts, and they don't need as much space to cool everything, right?
Mm-hmm. That's basically it. So, I mean, I'm going to just jump off that question you asked Igor, Ben, but like, where is Apple headed? Like, it's integration of all these different pieces of hardware, I think, into their idea of Apple Intelligence is going to more unify the idea of you owning Apple devices, right? So it's going to be the smarter Siri that's with you all day on your iPhone, but can seamlessly transition to your Mac and help you out. Like, it's going to be a Siri that you can talk to and maybe give it some tasks.
Can you send that to my iPad sort of stuff?
Basically. And you can already do that. You can already send a tab to your iPad or your iPhone, like swap between devices with what's the feature?
Yes, but you can't talk to it like Jarvis right now.
You can't talk to it like Jarvis, but like the future is like something you can talk to. And the question is like, how much control do we want to give over to that thing? And I think of all the companies doing this, like, Microsoft has been so desperate with Copilot, so freaking thirsty. OpenAI is out here being like, is this good? Hey, they just announced another giant round of funding, but they're just throwing everything at the walls. Oh, Sora's bad. Sora's bad for society and also draining us money. I guess that's dead now. Those aren't serious people.
No sexy mode.
Oh, yeah. Who could have thought that was a bad idea? To quote Succession, these are not serious people. Apple, at the very least, they are serious people, and they're serious about the idea of personal computing. They're not perfect. I've criticized them a lot. I've written articles about their freaking $1,000 wheels for the Mac Pros, or it was like a stand for one of the professional monitors that was nearly $1,000. Like, really stupid stuff. But at the end of the day, the stuff that is mostly consumer facing does seem more thoughtful these days. So we will see where it's all going. I think that my main takeaway, just thinking about like Apple at 50 years and looking at where all these other companies are right now, Apple's kind of in a place of strength because of the quality of their products. You could argue that Nvidia is in a place of strength, or OpenAI is, because they're making a ton of money. Nvidia is like heading up the AI, the entire AI industry. But if that bubble pops, Nvidia is kind of doomed. OpenAI is certainly doomed. Like, that is a lot of clout and money and reputation being hinged upon a single industry. Whereas if the AI bubble pops, Apple just keeps going, making good devices, and then like maybe trying to... Built for resilience and also built for practicality in a way that I think is more useful than like the hype cycles we've seen. We saw the Web3 hype cycle, the crypto hype cycle. I think we're in the middle of the AI hype cycle, and this one will probably stay because there are certain aspects of AI and the AI industry that does affect personal computing and will affect like how we interact with computers. But it's not going to be like the thing these folks are talking about. Go listen to my interview with the director of the AI doc, which is a separate episode on the feed this week. But, you know, we talked about that. And like, since making that movie, he is talking about like just having a lot less faith in the people of Silicon Valley, have a thinking Sam Altman is like even more of a dweeb and more of like an untrustworthy guy. Like even he is like seeing what they're doing. So AI may stick around, but it may not be mean certain doom. It may not mean any of that. And I think at the end of the
day, it will stick around. The question is what version of it?
I always
yeah. think back to our conversation a few weeks ago with Will Smith, where he said AI is definitely going to continue to be a thing. Large language models are going to still be pretty big. The transformer model is like unarguably a huge step forward, but we're probably not looking at the crop of companies that truly change things right now.
Yeah. Or maybe there are sturdy, strong companies with good products and strong revenue already that can just withstand some of these body blows, these industry body blows. And maybe some of these things won't work out. I think Apple moving to the transformer model for autocorrect has been kind of a disaster. My autocorrect is so bad right now. I want to dive a little more into that because I'm like making simple typos and it's recommending the dumbest stuff or not even catching them. And I feel like things were better a couple of years ago. So we'll see. There's a lot of stuff we'll see. Apple is now 50 years old. And I think at least among the tech companies today, it's probably one of the few that will still be around in the next 50 years.
I mean, certainly, like you don't hear about Tim Cook listening to AI summaries of his favorite podcast on his drive to like the office, right?
You don't hear about
Damn,
that,
Igor. You're so right.
You're so right. Well, what you do hear about Tim Cook doing though is giving Donald Trump golden statues and attending his dinners and stuff. Like, listen, everyone is embarrassing right now. I think the entire tech industry is absolutely embarrassing. At the very least, you can argue like what Tim Cook is doing is like just out of a place of like chill with the tariffs. Like, let us be okay with the tariffs here. Ideologically, I don't think it's revealing anything for him. But the idea that Satya Nadella can willingly be like, hey, I'm just offloading brain power to this machine. Is it? Summarizing these podcasts correctly? Am I thinking as deeply about these topics as I should be? He's willingly telling us he's making himself dumber, essentially.
Well, and also it's just so like, I listen to podcasts because of the people talking on it and their personality and their voice. So why, like, it just seems like such a strange way to enjoy the medium, right?
Like, all they want is information, like pure information distilled to their brains. And I listen to some podcasts for that too, or some audiobooks, but it kind of goes back to the Mark Andreessen thing where he recently said he does not believe in introspection or inner thoughts or anything like that. And I'm like, yes, that actually makes sense. For a lot of Silicon Valley, that absolutely makes sense. Let's move on to other news. And we've got a lot of other news this week. I think one of the biggest things is that the Artemis II launch happened and was successful for the most part. This is NASA's first major trip back to the moon with manned, you know, with actual astronauts. I saw I was watching the launch from my phone, unfortunately, because my kids demanded to go to the playground right after dinner. So like, it was a scene, and at least I was able to share it with them. Were you guys paying attention to this launch at all?
I knew when it was, but I
Come
was
on.
Doing other stuff. I know. I would have had to like sit down and again, like watch it on the street in New York City.
It's fine. Do that. Like a moment where everybody sits down and like looks at their phones. Like it's a big deal. I was heartened to see like the NASA stream online had like over 1 million live viewers at the same time. Like people are interested. It is hard to get super excited about space right now and this in general, because this is just a mission with four astronauts, right? And they're going to be orbiting the moon and taking a close look, but that's the closest we've been to the moon for decades. They're not landing on the moon. That's a whole separate thing that would have to happen for that. But this is still a pretty significant thing.
And these people are going to be the furthest away of any human beings from Elon Musk.
For now, we will talk about the SpaceX IPO and like what his plans are. He's like, oh no, I gotta get up there. I gotta make some more money and do this.
I mean, there was also like the idea of, okay, we're going to like take a look at the moon, and then the idea is to maybe try to put a base on it. But that kind of politicizes space. There's the idea of moon neutrality. And, you know, should there be an international moon base, mm-hmm. or should there be a just us, USA, USA moon base? On the other hand, space has been political for a really long time. Think about spy satellites. Think about all the talk people have made about dropping tungsten rods from low Earth orbit on bunkers.
Yeah. I'm just reminded of the movie Ad Astra, which is otherwise very average. It's that Brad Pitt one. But what I love about it is the depiction of the moon, where it's just, you see all these brands like FedEx and McDonald's on the moon. And so
it's hilarious. It's hilarious.
Just moving capitalism to space, right?
It's the one of the biggest jokes in that movie, because that is a pretty self-serious movie, and I like it quite a bit from one of my like favorite modern directors. But it's like, Applebee's on the moon. You know what that means? Essentially, like, oh, this is not a Verhoeven movie. This is just, yeah, we're just going to make the moon a strip mall, because that's all we can do. That's all our culture can do right now.
Yeah. Like, imagine that depressing picture of that one off-ramp in California where it's just chain restaurant, gas station, chain restaurant, but on the moon's South Pole. Mm-hmm. Speaking of bringing capitalism to space, though, SpaceX just filed for the biggest IPO in history. It wants a valuation of $1.75 trillion, and they want to raise $75 billion in this IPO. I just did a little research on how big an IPO that is, how big a raise it is. And big dog, that's 2.9, basically three times the size of Saudi Aramco's IPO in 2019. What the hell?
Yeah, and so this is the article that I wrote about a while back about their plan to put data centers in space. And I think this is going to be maybe the most important thing in our lifetime, right? Whether they're successful in this, right? Because,
of putting data centers in space.
Well, if they can raise this money, right? There's like so many angles to this, right? Like if it all falls through, right? Like I think at their valuation, they would already be in the S&P 500, right? And then if this falls through, that's like contagion everywhere, right? But, we got instances of SpaceX or Starlink satellites not either being close to colliding or something going on with them. And we're seeing, you know, like it's a very likelihood, you know, we talked about monopolies, but with this amount of money, they could very easily monopolize all the orbits around the planet. And that would just be terrible for every other country and humanity more broadly, you know?
It would be terrible. It would be terrible, yeah. Terrible on multiple levels. I saw some really interesting chatter, I don't know, online yesterday where people were like, yeah, the SpaceX stuff is interesting. Nationalize SpaceX. Bring our money back. Bring all the money the U.S. essentially has invested in Elon Musk and bring it back home. That's an interesting thought. If only something like that. I don't know. That's a whole thing. Like, that brings us into other territory and how other countries have nationalized businesses. But also, I don't know, maybe this guy who is out here throwing Nazi salutes should not be in charge of these massive companies, and we have good reason to think about the money that the U.S. has invested in them. I don't know.
Igor, I think it's good that you brought up the idea of AI data centers, because when I was first writing this story out in our show notes, I was like, man, the people who are spacefaring true believers must really believe in this, that they can get a IPO raise that is more valuable than petrocarbons when the Strait of Hormuz is still closed. Mm-hmm. But it's not just the idea of maybe there's gold in them thar hills and it's really important to be a spacefaring society. I think it is about the low orbit AI data centers.
Sure.
And there's no proof that that can exist in the very near term, like when the bill comes due.
Yeah. So I recommend everyone. In writing my story, I spoke to this guy called Andrew McCallop. And so Andrew, created this incredible website where you can see the breakdown of how much it would cost to put data centers in space. And there's all these really cool sliders that you can move around to see how the cost is changes, right? The caveat being that this is all like, we just like don't know what the hard numbers are. And this is a lot of, you know, like extrapolation. But on even with Starship, which isn't a craft that is ready to fly yet, it would cost like three times as much as building a data center on Earth. And yet what he told me was really interesting is that, you know, people emailed him from like hedge funds and they're like, oh no, we're using this to argue the bull case for this. Like, you know, and, you know, so I think there's like a, this class of investors who are just convinced because of like that, like maybe this regulatory environment that is in space right now will continue to exist where, you know, you can basically, the FCC is just like, yeah, you can put up whatever you want, right? Like, and...
Okay, so they're basically saying it's free real estate.
It's, well, yeah, right? It is a real estate race, right? There's a lot here that like, they're frustrated with how slowly these buildouts are going on Earth. They think this is a like cheaper, more affordable, or not cheaper necessarily, but it's even if it's the second best option, that's good enough. But there's just so many unknowns, right? And I just don't know how this makes sense in any by any metric, right? Environmental, economic, you know, like
it, so basically this valuation and raise is saying like, not only are we a space company, we're an AI company, and we're mm-hmm. also CoreWeave.
I mean, yeah, it's nuts. There's a lot of nuts things happening. I do want to point this thing out around the Artemis launch, which I saw online. People were like splicing bits of the live stream. And apparently at one point, the astronauts were calling Houston because they had computer issues.
We suspect the issue with your PCD may be Optimus software. We were able to connect to PCD 1 on, we can see it on the network. So with your Go, we can remote in and take a look directly.
Yeah, go for it. And then I also see that I have two Microsoft Outlooks and neither one of those are working. If you want to remote in and check Optimus on those two Outlooks, that would be awesome.
I believe NASA, whoever their IT help is, had to remote into those computers on Artemis, which is cool as hell.
I did see a tweet from Tom Warren from The Verge, and he was like, it was like the legacy version and the new version of Outlook conflicting with one another.
It happens. It's such a like relatable moment. IT problem. Yeah. So relatable. Just hilarious. Even
astronauts,
NASA,
they're just like us.
Well, mm-hmm. NASA, they're just like us. Yeah.
Just to close the loop on the SpaceX thing, right now there are somewhere between like 9,300 and 10,000 SpaceX satellites in orbit. There have been two that broke up in the last like 6 months or so. SpaceX says they want to put like a million more in orbit, and that's what would contribute to their AI data center strategy. But then you start having to think about Kessler syndrome. The idea that SpaceX's value is in how can we put more stuff up in space and how can we fully escape Earth's orbit to become a multiplanetary species. But if there's too much junk in space, you can't put the rocket through the patch of junk. The vehicle explodes and everybody dies.
Well, I mean, so one of the professors I spoke to from my article, he mentioned that like we're already in the early stages of Kessler syndrome and you're very much,
oh, great.
You know, you're already looking at a situation.
Greenhouse effect on land, Kessler syndrome in space.
Yeah. And you're already looking at a scenario where like, you know, one thing that Andrew's website doesn't factor in is like, what is if Kessler syndrome is a thing and we have to start launching into debris, what is the attrition rate of these satellites when they just start hitting each other, right? So you're going to have to factor in at one point the price of just like, we're going to lose these satellites to collisions, right? If you just go on pretending this is not going to be an issue, right?
What about the existential risk of not being able to do proper astronomy because there's too much stuff between the ground-based telescopes and the rest of space?
Yeah, see, that's an interesting one because everyone's like, a couple of the people who were positive of this was said to me like, well, it's better to do it from space, right? Like pointing to things like the Webb telescope. But I'm like, sure, man, it took the Webb, like, you know, it took billions of dollars and like, you know, years to get that up into space. And where is the private like enterprise that is going to be like, I'm going to fund like space telescopes, right? I believe like Eric Schmidt, the former CEO of Google, is like involved in something like this, but
Unless it's making money. Unless like it's a thing either extracting resources or a thing you can sell to people. There's no reason to do
that. Okay, so we're going to sell asteroid detection as a service?
Oh, cool. Now you're cooking. Now you're cooking.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's just, I mean, and
what would you call that? Asteroid safety service. I feel like there's a good acronym for something there. Something there. The thing, we should bring this up, because what's tough when talking about Starlink and SpaceX is that, unfortunately, Starlink is a good product. Unfortunately, it is very fast and people really like it and it works well. God damn it. So what do we do? What do we do about that, too? Because I think they can argue that we are providing a good service here, right? There are a lot of arguments like they should be allowed to do this, especially when it comes to like rural internet access and things like that. Do we need more, just more regulation around these companies launching satellites? Is that the main answer here?
I mean, I think, you know, like we saw recently in the Ukraine war, right, when Russia lost access to Starlink because the Ukrainians like basically reverse engineered something and showed that Russia was using Starlink, that the like pace of the war completely changed, right? I think just on the basis of that, like the answer is yes, we need more regulation because... You know, like that's just crazy that, you know, they were basically assisting the Russians, right? So I think like, I mean, I come from like, I was born in a communist country, so I'm all for like nationalizing SpaceX. But is that a realistic option in the US given even like just forgetting the current political climate? You know, like even if something were to change, right? Like, you know, I saw on 404 Media, someone, I forget the writer, but I think it was Jason. He said, you know, we should view SpaceX as Elon's most political enterprise, right? It is the company, I mean, especially now that it's this like three like headed dog, right? But like, it is the company with the most impact on like, that will have the most impact on the future of humanity and like how things are done on planet, on Earth and elsewhere.
That's scary to think about in that respect, because once again, this is a man publicly throwing out Nazi salutes. So what do you do with that to have that be such an influential company? I don't know.
On top of the fact that you can't go to space to escape capitalism anymore.
Mm.
Red alert 2, baby. Or was it 3? Yeah.
Oh, Tim Curry, thank you for that line, among so many others. Another big story that we got to talk about. I'm really happy that Igor is here to talk about it.
You're the perfect one for this, Igor. Yeah.
Anthropic accidentally leaked Claude Code source code. Tell us how big a deal this is, please.
Honest, this is not going to be a very satisfying answer, but I don't. It's hard to say, right? Because I think like I've seen some like people that like just make fun of the code and be like, oh, this is written by amateurs, right? And you can clearly tell that Claude Code generated some of its own code, right? And it's like the reality...
Oh, I mean, Boris Cherney says that Claude Code is itself built by Claude Code.
Yeah. Yeah. The reality is that really what makes a successful product is not necessarily the quality of the code, it's just that it works, right? And clearly Claude Code works, right? And so, like, how many games have, like, spaghetti code, right? Like, right, you know, right, World of Warcraft, famously, after 20 years, was just, like, an incomprehensible mess, right? But it still worked. It was still the most popular MMO. And you have Claude Code here, the most one of the most popular IDEs now, or sorry, excuse me, command line coding tools. And how much can OpenAI figure out from this just by looking at the code of Claude Code? I don't know, because it isn't... What wasn't in the source code here was how the models worked, right? It's just the app, right? So, and I think these apps change so quickly that it's hard to say. But is it a big fuck up? Totally. And, you know, they're probably like, someone lost their job at Anthropic. So.
I mean, so let's recap what just happened. So like some of the code for Claude Code, you got to make a good tongue twister rhyme with this. Claude Code code got...
How much code could Claude Code code if Claude Code could code Claude?
Yeah.
Question mark?
Basically, that's basically what happened. But Claude Code's code got leaked and people noticed. And I believe it was immediately thrown into a GitHub repository and also kind of changed in a way where OpenAI.
So copied basically tens of thousands of times, right? So there's no way this, like, there's no putting the genie. Yeah, it's out there. Yeah.
I saw a lot of AI boosters because I think we didn't write a story until late, and a lot of the mainstream press was, but the people who were really into AI were foaming at the mouth yesterday morning about this. They're like, oh my God, it's all out there. I could take this. I could put it in my own little machine, put it on my Mac Mini and start to build my own Claude code thing. Just wild. It'll be interesting to see if anything comes of this.
There was a good thread about this on a Mastodon sub-distro, and I'm not going to go through all of it, of course, because honestly, I don't understand all of it. It is interesting, however, that the code includes some of the prompts that were used to generate it.
Yeah.
Here's an example. Be careful not to introduce security vulnerabilities such as command injection, XSS, SQL injection, and other... Is that OWASP or OWASP, top 10 vulnerabilities? If you notice that you wrote insecure code, immediately fix it. Prioritize writing safe, secure, and correct code.
It's that easy.
Makes sense if you're a hobbyist.
Tell it to behave.
That's a lot of fun if you're I'm going to do this on my own little Mac Mini. The idea that they're doing this for enterprise software, basically just saying please, can you write good code? Oh my goodness.
This is the company that's supposed to be doing AI good, right? By the way, this is the company that's supposed to be thinking more deeply about AI. So this is also why I'm saying hey, I know you guys all thought it was cool that Anthropic tried to stand up to the DoD. There are many reasons we should not valorize this company much. Maybe they're slightly less evil than OpenAI, but they're all pretty stupid. And it's stuff like this that we'll keep unearthing. This is why I'm saying, I don't think their AI will take over the world, guys. I think we're okay.
Fingers crossed.
And more broadly, I hate to break it to everyone, but this is the level of system prompts that you see on most services, right? It doesn't really get much more advanced than this, right? You can look at not that this is a great example, but you can look at Grok's system level prompts because, they're publicly available, and it's, this is not PhD level stuff we're talking about here. Yeah.
These are not serious people. These are not serious people. Don't forget that. Don't forget that. All these companies in OpenAI and everybody stumbled into this, and they're all trying to, I don't know, get a handle of the AI industry that they have right now. One quick thing I want to mention, because we didn't mention it last week, but the US has banned all foreign-made network routers. And that's a really interesting development, and it kind of took everybody by surprise. And it's a big deal because that includes Chinese companies like TP-Link, who I think have typically produced some of the best networking hardware. They're the stuff we typically recommend. But also American companies like Netgear, Eero, Google Nest, they're building their stuff in Asia as well. So who is left here? Igor, have you thought at all about this story? Because this seems like a really strange situation. I don't know if it's full-on, xenophobia or something, similar to the TikTok sale, but what?
Mm-hmm. Who's left here is Starlink, right?
Yeah.
I remember learning about protectionism in high school history class, and it was always presented as the, oh wow, well, we've left the old ways of the past. We're in the American unipolar moment, so we don't have to worry about that anymore. Whoops.
Whoopsie. This is not the same as the Huawei ban, which I think was kind of done more based on things that they've noticed that Huawei was doing as a company. And wasn't there the Huawei executive too, who was essentially a spy for China? Wasn't that the story? That had some actual espionage aspects to it. This, I don't know.
I think there's also a big difference between Huawei, Chinese company based in China versus, Google getting their things produced in,
for sure,
China or Taiwan or whatever else.
Yeah. Or even something like TP-Link, I'd say. We don't know what this will lead to or if this is going to have any standing. And also, something I got to keep reminding myself, this administration is not here forever. They are not here forever.
I hope so. I'm crossing my fingers.
Yeah.
We are counting down the days. There are still legal precedents in mind. You know, they tried to take away birthright citizenship yesterday. And, you know, there's a lot of things they're trying to do, and they won't all succeed. And hopefully, like, even if something like actually happens, like this this announcement was made, like it can all be reversed down the line. This is just kind of a weird thing we're in right now.
Dev, I thought you were going to talk about how this might be a shakedown, though.
I mean, it might be a shakedown. I think you had that concept, but listen, isn't everything here kind of a shakedown? The TikTok deal was essentially a shakedown.
Let me read the text from a FCC document. They say that they have a list of companies granted conditional approval after finding such device or devices does not pose such unacceptable risks. Producers of consumer-grade routers are encouraged to submit an application for conditional approval using the guidance attached to this determination. So this is basically like, please submit another application, and then whatever the fee of that another application might be.
We'll see. It's always a shakedown with these folks. Yeah, go ahead.
Can I also just say, I remember when I first started at Engadget thinking Ajit Pai, there could not be a worse FCC commissioner. And then Brendan Carr comes along, and this guy is just a bozo, right? Like,
just a bozo.
Yeah.
Listen, there's a lot we could get into here. And also, we should talk about routers in general, like, because I think I was listening to Will Smith's other show, Will and Brad made a tech pod. a broader recommendation they've started having is just like, they're not telling people to get routers anymore. And it actually does make sense, because with a lot of ISPs, you're stuck with just the box they give you. I have AT&T and I have to have their freaking gigabyte box like on, because it's part of the service. There are workarounds around that, which could put your service at risk or could like lead to instability.
Do they charge you like a monthly rental fee for the box?
How all this works, because we have wonderful regulations in this country that make our internet prices so low. But yeah, yes, you are paying a monthly fee for that as well. A better recommendation, rather than like getting a whole new router in your system, is to get wireless APs and to start to build that out. So that's a way that you can spread, you know, wireless around your house, and those can also be upgraded more easily than your ISP's router too. So just something to think about, and we'll probably talk more about that down the line. Let's move on to what's going on around in gadgets, and a couple of reviews I want to shout out. Billy Steele reviewed the Apple AirPods Max 2. It's calling them better late than never. Overdue updates bring Apple's priciest AirPods on par with its best earbuds. He gave it a score of 87 out of 100. Says they're comfortable, have great sound quality, lots of new features. These are running the new, not new really, but they're running Apple's more recent H2 audio chip, which allows for things like adaptive audio and live translation. The design hasn't changed, though. They're still super expensive, and they only have one hearing health feature, whereas the AirPods Pro 3, which are like magical little devices, have a whole bunch of things that can kind of help your hearing. I've been telling you this, like, this is like sometimes the irrational things that happen. I see a product, I'm like, I don't need this. This is too expensive, but I do kind of want it. So anyway, but I'm not going to talk more about that on an episode where we already glazed Apple quite a bit. Billy really liked this, and I think if you were holding off on the AirPods Max in general, this seems like a good one. Sam Rutherford reviewed the Robeson Soundwave, a childhood dream made real, he calls it. It's a $1,400 transformer that can actually transform. That's cool. That's super cool. It transforms and walks on its own.
I've seen videos of this. It does look pretty cool. Yeah.
It has voice lines by Frank Welker. It can be a Bluetooth speaker and recorder. This would be the ultimate thing to have behind you in a podcast, by the way. This is my speakerphone. It's Soundwave. Hello, say hello to Soundwave. That's super cool. Sam also has a listing of some of the hottest EVs from the 2026 New York Auto Show. Some really cool stuff here. Subaru has a three-row EV SUV finally, the Subaru Getaway, which looks boring as hell. But then Hyundai introduced their Boulder concept, which is like a concept that's going to be taking on the Forerunner, like a big, rugged, you know, SUV that Americans love. There are some, you know, value to having something like the Forerunner as a family hauler. Like, I will admit, I live in the suburbs. I see why people get these things. Kia has the EV3, which looks like a cute little two-door EV. But really, what is going on over at Hyundai over here? I'm going to talk about this. The Hyundai Ioniq 5 XRT. Look at this. This is just a cool Ioniq 5 with like more rugged tires. Has the roof racks.
You got to be on YouTube to see this one. Usually we're audio only, but yes, we're looking at pictures of cars right now.
We're looking at pictures of cars. So go take a look at some of these.
Deb, can I ask you a question?
Yeah. Yeah.
Why are these EV makers not seizing the moment and making cheap EVs, you know, like, you know, the oil, it's going to, who knows, we're looking maybe at a potential future where it's like $200, you know, a barrel, mm-hmm. right, in the US.
I hear you. I think these are, so it takes a long time. There's a long lead time in designing cars. They can't just turn around and do things so quickly. We have seen some of those. Like, I really like the Nissan Leaf redesign, the 2026 redesign of the Leaf. That thing starts at basically $30,000. And I think other companies are trying to like produce cheaper ones, but at the end of the day, it's all about margins, right? It's about what you put in and how much bank you can make from these things. And most companies, certainly not Toyota or Honda, have done a good job of like building out their EV development where they can produce cheap cars. Hyundai and Kia have been doing EVs for a lot longer, and honestly, their whole thing has always been quality at a low cost. So I think that's kind of it. That's kind of what they're doing. Like the Kia EV3 I was talking about, like, starts at $35,000. If you want a cheap EV, we've talked about this on the show, go look at used cars. Go look at what's out there. You can get a Nissan Leaf around $15,000 or less, like $10,000 to $15,000 for like the second gen Leaf with the bigger batteries. If you just need something to like putt-putt around your like local town, you could get the cheaper older Leafs for like under $10,000 easily. The Ioniq 5 I see on sale for around $20,000 to $25,000. For used car prices, that's not too bad. So if you want a cheap EV, look at the used market. They're out there. One thing I want to mention real quick, the Genesis GV60 Magma. This thing is the Genesis version of the Ioniq 5, and it just looks incredible. Like, it's just a really sharp color, great lines, great design here. Genesis is Hyundai's high-end brand, so there's that. Check out these pictures and Sam slots on our site. There's a Corvette CX concept. This is the freaking Mach 5. This is like a future EV version of Speed Racer's Mach 5. That's cool. Lots of cool cars. Lots of cool coverage there. Let's move on to what we're working on. I'll be doing a review of the Asus ZenBook A16. The A14 I saw last year, that was their like 2-pound 14-incher. The ZenBook A16 is only slightly heavier. It's kind of wild. And it's running one of the newer Snapdragon chips. So I'm interested in seeing how that performs. Igor, anything you want to shout out?
Yeah, so Aaron, our editor-in-chief, graciously allowed me to do a very like weird article, which is I bought a used Nintendo DS and I'm going to try rebuilding it in a new shell with new battery and stuff, and then just write about the process of like upgrading like what is now like a 20-year-old, you know, device. So I'm really excited to do that, just something a little quirky and off the beaten path.
That's cool. A lot of like retro tech I'm seeing on like TikTok and elsewhere too. This is really the year of rebuilding and buying used tech and DIY tech solutions. So I'm interested in seeing how that goes, Igor. Good luck. Good luck. Let's move on to our pop culture picks for the week. Ben, you've got something interesting here. I want to hear you talk about that.
So I have been listening to this new album. It was released in August of last year by a Australian electronic music producer named Nina Jirachi. I've seen so much about like I Love My Computer in my various social feeds for the last like several weeks, and I was like, okay, let's listen to it. It's weird listening to a producer album a lot of times, because if you're like a DJ producer, you're mostly focused on that first thing. In a lot of cases, there will be internationally touring DJs doing really well that don't have a lot of music out. Like, it's kind of a vanity project to release an album of your originals so that you can include them in your sets later on, you know, at all of the festivals and your gigs globally. This album is so good. It's not just because it reminds me of some of my favorite producers from 10 or 15 years ago when they were getting started. Madion, Porter Robinson, like very early Skrillex. But it's just, it has really good heart, which is hard to come by in this kind of like high-flying main room EDM social circle. A lot of these people are too cool for school. Meanwhile, Nina made a song on this album called Sing Good about generally not being great at music, but just being really like enamored with it and wanting to get better at it through hard work and dedication. She's set. This is a wonderful, wonderful like artist statement. It's not going to convince you that you love EDM if you don't already like it, but if you're already interested in this sort of thing, I think you should really go check it out, because it starts out as a seamless set and then goes on to be bigger, more conceptual tracks with, you know, a little bit of silence in between.
The Pitchfork review for this thing reminds me why I can't write or conceptualize music reviews, because it's just words I don't understand. Tech house, speed garage. I know what dubstep is. I know what hyperpop is, but all those things apply to this album, apparently. So very cool pick, Ben.
Yeah, I mean, when I was listening to it, I was like, wow, this really sounds like Porter Robinson's early Complextro. And that's another term that's...
I love that album, yeah.
Yeah, that's what's up. Like, I understand what's going on. But like, seriously, if you like electronic music, if any of these terms that Dev just said or I just said actually make sense, then you should go check this album out. And hopefully you're as endeared to like Sing Good and Delete as I am. Or wait, is it Delete or Battery Death? Both of those songs are just really good. And I think they'd be like really up the alley of any Engadget listener, because this is a very like, I spend all of my time on the computer sort of album.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you. I love your music picks, Ben. Thank you. Igor, anything you want to quickly shout out? I know you have a show that I love here.
Yeah. DTF St. Louis. I've been watching it with my partner. It's just, I don't know how you would describe this, Dev, because
it's hilarious. Like,
It's like, it's very like Lynchian, right?
Yes.
Where it's like,
yes,
the sense of humor is very like off kilter. And I don't almost want to say too much about it, because I think if you can go into it without like any like preconceived notion of the plot and stuff, it's just so funny and like just so masterful. And if Jason Bateman doesn't get an Emmy nom, like his acting in it is just like, it's just like otherworldly, right? Like his like facial expressions, his like everything about how he acts. And like, he's such a good dork in this, like maybe he's the best portrayal of a dork I've ever seen. And please, please give this show a chance. It's so good.
He's a dork, especially because he has a recumbent bike. And whenever you see a recumbent bike and anything, you're like, yep, I know who that person is. I know exactly who that person is. But yeah, Jason Bateman, David Harbour, Linda Cardellini, incredible, incredible cast.
Yeah.
Have you seen Patriot, Igor, which is Stephen
Conrad? No, so this is where it's on our watch list. We want to really watch it because apparently it's incredible, right? And it has John Locke from Lost.
It has John Locke from Lost. It has one of the guys from For All Mankind in it. And yeah, I've talked about this before, but it's about a spy who wants to be a folk singer. He does these really weird off-kilter comedies. I'm just like fully on his wavelength. DTF St. Louis is great. Like even the sets in DTF St. Louis are funny. Like, why are you having an interrogation in this like brutalist like lobby of this police building? And I was like, oh, this can't get any weirder. They go into the interrogation room, which is just like all black. Just also, it's all, if you find those sorts of things funny and like those little details funny, just the humor in it's great. Check out DTF St. Louis. Anything else, Igor?
Yeah. If I can recommend a music pick,
go for it.
Tom Misch, he's a great like neo soul guitarist and singer songwriter. He just released an album called Full Circle. he's just like a really amazing jazz guitarist, and I like really love his music. It's really, there's a wonderful song about his relationship with his sisters on the album. So if you like something like a bit smoother than EDM, I think this is a great alternative.
You need to be able to hop over to other things. Very cool. Very cool. Thank you so much. I've got a recommendation and an anti-recommendation. I'll put it that way. Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie. I think you recommended I check this out too, Igor, right?
Oh, it's so good.
It's like, so good.
I think you'd lose your citizenship if you didn't, Igor.
Yeah.
Also, a thing that's hard to describe, but it is from the director and writers of the Blackberry movie, and I love that movie so much. I'm like, I'm going to see whatever you guys do, because clearly you are geniuses or something going on here. That's Matt Johnson and Jay McCarroll. But this is a continuation of a web series that was on Vice way back in the day, where it was like two guys trying to get their band to show at the Rivoli in Toronto. The movie is a continuation of that, and it goes places. It goes places. But I will just say two words. This movie begins with the opening melody from Chrono Trigger. And I have not been so like locked in, like, you know, I know who you are. You know who I am. You are made for me. It's hilarious. It just goes places you would not expect. I think it's incredible. So check out Nirvana, the band, the show, the movie. It's on VOD right now. I believe it's like $15 to rent, $20 to purchase. Blind Buy. If you like geeky independent movies, if you like sci-fi and creative stuff, Blind Buy. It's incredible. Anti-recommendation. The Super Mario Galaxy movie, which I saw last night. It's a black hole. It's just a black hole.
Fox could not save it.
No. Fox is great. Fox is in it for like maybe 5 minutes, and they have fun with Fox. Like, and it's freaking what's his face?
Colin Powell? Not Colin Powell.
It's Glenn Powell doing it.
Yeah.
And he's doing like
big difference, Igor.
Big difference.
But it's Glenn Powell like being kind of cheesy and like being the coolest guy in the room, and he does that pretty well, even with just his voice. And they have a lot of fun. They even do like a little bit of a Star Trek, a Star Fox anime intro for him, which is kind of cool.
Oh, amazing!
All that stuff is great. That is 5 minutes of a movie that is so boring. So like, why are things happening? I don't know why things are happening. It's just loud sounds, shiny visuals. The visuals are good because it's Illumination, and they can make high quality stuff when they choose to. But yeah, this movie goes nowhere. I have forgotten it immediately. I thought the first movie was fine, but really, really basic. And I think my basic takeaway is like, this is less of a movie than the first movie. This is a movie where they knew they didn't even have to try. They'll make $1 billion just by shitting this thing out. So I hate this movie. I'll be writing a full review on Engadget sometime soon. It's real bad. Do not see it in theaters. Do not take your kids to this movie. It's real bad.
Setting up a Smash Bros. Movie?
It kind of is. I mean, that's what they want. They want the Avengers moment. But yeah, what was the Pixar one that just came out about the beavers?
Oh, I don't know.
Hoppers. It is Hoppers, and Hoppers was fantastic. Take your kids to Hoppers. That's still in theaters. Funny, genuinely funny. Hoppers is fantastic. So anyway, God, I raced to see the Mario Galaxy movie last night because like I knew I'd need some time to write about it and talk about it. But who, buddy? It's real bad, so stay away from that thing.
That's it for this week's episode. Thank you for listening. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our former managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. And the podcast is produced by me, Ben Elman. You can find Devendra online at...
at Devendra on Blue Sky, and a podcast about movies and TV at The Filmcast at thefilmcast.com. And, oh yeah, be sure to check out our interview with the director of the AI doc in this feed.
And you can find Igor online at...
at Igor Bonifacic, that's Bonifacic, at Blue Sky.
You can send more recommendations for EDM sub genres to me on Blue Sky at Hey Bellman. Email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts. That includes Spotify.